Stories from Super Touring. Hey.
Donington was playing host to the European Grand Prix in early 1993, and the British Touring Car Championship came along for the ride. Whilst Ayrton Senna produced one of the most memorable drives of his career in the F1, Tim Harvey produced a similarly spectacular drive to take Renault's first ever BTCC victory in the support race. All this was after a distinctly poor debut for the French marque just a fortnight earlier. Welcome to the latest episode of Stories from Super Touring. I'm Levi Riley, and to help look back at this race meeting, Alex, Adam and myself are joined by Stories from Super Touring newbie, motorsport photographer Greg Denton. Thanks for joining us, everyone. How are we all today?
Yeah, not bad, thank you. Yeah, very good,
thanks.
Looking forward to, a rather bizarre race, this one. It's one that is fondly remembered, and I'm looking forward to going through it, but it's a bit of a crazy one.
And now, Greg, coming to you first. This is your, as I said, your first appearance on Stories from Super Touring. So thanks for joining us today. Just before we go a bit more into the race event, how did you get into the sport, first of all?
Yeah, I think it really started with my dad. He was a big motorsport fan. And in the 60s and 70s, he used to work for Ford Motor Company. And he had the very great privilege of, after every British Grand Prix, he used to actually get to drive the winning car and driver around the circuit driving the tractor. So we've got lots of great pictures of him taking Jim Clark, Peter Revson, and so forth around the circuit. So he always had the bug. And then obviously he used to introduce it to me, watching Grandstand, watching Bathurst, Rallycross, and then obviously the touring cars. And I think I nagged him enough, and we went along to my first meeting at Thruxton in 1987. And I was actually looking at the programme because I've still got it, and it was a British Formula 3 event, but it was the touring cars were supporting it. And I looked, it was a paltry 15-car entry across four classes. I think Dennis Leach won in a Rover, and actually Tim Harvey was actually racing in it, and also his Rover. So yeah, once I saw cars in the flesh, that was it. I was hooked.
Fantastic. And we'll stick for you first for our usual opening question, which is, what first comes to your mind when you think about this classic race from the early part of 1993?
Yeah, I think it can't be anything other than the weather. It was really, truly awful.
Yeah.
I think we got to the circuit about 5 o'clock in the morning. We were sat on the outside of the Craner curves, and by this time of part of the weekend, the banks were just like mud. There was actually people that said, I can't sit through this any longer because it just didn't stop raining. So 7, 8 o'clock in the morning, people were already leaving the circuit, which may be why the circuit didn't look so busy, because there was lots of people there, but they all decided to leave. Mm. So, the weather was just truly awful.
Yeah, I think that's going to be a common theme of probably some of the things we say on this episode. Adam, coming to you next, what jumps into your mind thinking about this race?
Very similar, but quite a few things. I mean, obviously Formula One, you know, I know that we're here to talk about touring cars, but this was Formula One at Donington for the first time. The Melbourne Loop comes into it. That's where the Melbourne Loop was originally built for, because the circuit needed to have, it was too short basically. So they needed to add some length to it. So they just thought they'd put a nice boring straight and then a hairpin and a straight back. Like, you know, I think that's the space they had. So that's the space they used. But obviously, onto the touring car side, it was a very needed win for Renault. You know, they, you know, we'll go on to it further in, you know, talking about it. But just the performance from Renault and Tim and Menu, you know, it was a good result for them.
And finally, coming to you, Alan, what's your memories of this memorable race from 1993?
It's a bit of a strange one, but headlights, which
yellow ones,
yes, the very yellow headlights of the Renault. And then you had some people like Cleland and Soper running no headlights at all in that weather, which I always thought was just absolutely balmy.
You'd get that flag now, wouldn't you?
Yeah. And then you even had the green headlights from the Nissan of Odor, who had those strange advertising covers over his headlights, which made them look green. Mm. So you had a multicolor of different headlights, and that always really stuck in my mind. And when Percy would have been in the other Renault, and he'd have been in the other Nissan, and he would have had the red ones. So Yeah, it was just, it sounds bizarre, but headlights really are the first thing that stick into my mind.
Well, let's see if anyone else had those thoughts, because as ever, we did ask our faithful listeners what they thought of this race meeting through our social media channels. Unsurprisingly, perhaps, the weather is a major memory for most of you. Motorsport journalist Paul Thurnley said he remembers that was the race he found a hole in his Wellington boot. Not ideal to find that out.
No, not
it
in
is
that
devastating,
race.
Though, to be fair, when you do get a hole in the shoe in his way. It's not good, is it?
And Stuart Baines, George Clough, Dean Ibbotson, Tim Davies and Bob Sallows also naturally remembered the very wet weather conditions that day. Andy Taylor got in touch to say that his memory was getting very excited because this was the first Grand Prix he would ever attend, but also the first time he saw the BTCC in the flesh too. And I imagine quite a lot of people were probably exposed to the BTCC for the first time that day. If, of course, they hadn't gone home to dry out after the F1. Yeah,
by 8 o'clock in the morning. Yeah. Before free practice.
I think most people would have... This would have been the first year since Silverstone 92. And that is what brought a lot of people's attention to touring cars.
Yeah.
So 93, probably, I'm guessing, would have had a whole new raft of fans following the sport for the first time.
Yeah, and what a weekend to do. You got Formula One and touring cars on the same weekend.
Yeah, exactly.
So
brilliant.
Good value for money, really, for the ticket.
Daniel Francis, he told us that his first memory of that event was how long it took to get home from the circuit. And that was bearing in mind that he only lived 10 miles away. Ed Cavallari, he said that his memories are of a stunning win for Tim Harvey. He showed that he was a true champion that day by winning in an uncompetitive car. Whilst Daryl Benj has got all Marty Pello on us and just says, wet, wet, wet. Sam Chapman, he mentioned the Michelin tyres, saying that they had produced a wet tyre that was twice as good as anyone else. Whilst Paul Lloyd went down a slightly different route, saying that quite simply the Renault 19 was the worst ever car to win a BTCC race.
I mean,
that's a statement.
I can't think of another one that...
I think it's not far from the truth.
I don't think so, yeah. I can't think of another one that was as uncompetitive as it was, generally, to then suddenly take a win. But it took two, of course, as well. But there we go.
And Ian Davies said that everyone raves about Donington 1998, but we'll see what you guys think about this. He believes that this race was a better one than Donington 98.
Ooh. Ian.
Cardinal sin.
Not for me, but each to their own, each to their own. It was a brilliant race, this race. I'm not saying that this wasn't a brilliant race, but I'm not sure it's Donington 98 level, though. For this series of Stories from Super Touring, we are delighted to be teaming up with Brands Hatch to give away two tickets to Super Touring Power 2, which is being held at the famous circuit on the 29th and 30th of June 2024. The award-nominated event was a smash hit last year when its debut edition transported fans back to the 90s, and this year's event will once again celebrate one of touring car racing's most fondly remembered eras. To enter the competition, just answer the following question. Who was the first ever guest to star on Stories from Super Touring? Send your answers to pod@1990sbtcc.com and we'll announce the winner on a later episode this series. Meanwhile, let's get back to the episode.
Heading into the weekend, and all the talk was on Ford and the development of their new Mondeo. As Autosport went for press on the Tuesday prior to the event, it was expected that Andy Rouse and Paul Radisich would debut the new cars at the Donington meeting. However, they would be withdrawn at the last minute. Ford's PR man, Stuart McCrudden, said that the car simply wasn't ready. The car's tested on Thursday, but they aren't yet quite on the pace, he told Autosport. Whilst Rouse and Radisich were only 0.08 apart in the test, they were over 5 seconds slower than Soper's BMW, who topped the timing. Adam, we won't dwell too much on this, as we have covered the Ford Mondeo development story in our Pembrey 1993 episode last series. But were you surprised that Ford made the last-minute decision to pull the entry for Donington?
Absolutely not. I think in a way, you look at it was a blessing that there were 5 seconds, because if there were one and a half seconds, that's an eternity.
Yeah.
So, but also that would have been a more difficult decision to make, because you think, do we risk it? Do we not risk it? We're not that far apart, especially from a PR perspective, because the 1.5 seconds is like the blink of an eye to them. But in racing terms, it is another calendar month, isn't it? You know, it's they made completely the right decision. You know, we've spoke about this before in terms of the testing they did at Pembrey and various different places to try and they were testing against the best there is. You know, that they want to get this car to be as competitive as they can. If they'd have gone testing on their own and then come there, they'd have had the shock of their life. So this is Ford. Like, this is one of the biggest brands in motor manufacturing, like, globally. So you're only ever going to be remembered for what you've achieved in a championship when you're coming in, you know, as big as they are. So could you imagine if they'd have come in and been an absolute flop? You know, we remember them for winning, doing great things, Mansell having an appearance, you know, it's all good news, isn't it? Could you imagine if they had made that decision with a car of 5 seconds slower? I mean, it would have helped obviously with the wet conditions, but you've then got to think of the next race and the one after that and the one after that. So 100% did they make the right decision.
Meanwhile, Tiff Nadell was announced as racing the second Acura Cost Cavalier at Donington, with the drive then being handed to Harry Nuttall for the remainder of the season after that. Team boss Ray Mallett told Autosport, "It would be asking a lot to put Harry in the car without a single test session, so we agreed it would be better to put Tiff in the car." Greg, can you understand the decision from Mallett there?
Yeah, I think in hindsight it was a really sensible decision. You know, to start a race such as that in front of one of the biggest crowds of the year would possibly have been too much for Harry. So getting an experienced hand in like Tiff would probably seem like the most sensible thing to do. But having watched the coverage back again and recognising that Tiff actually only made it to Redgate Corner, maybe in hindsight that actually wasn't the best thing. For all we know, Harry could have been the best wet weather master and could have got his best ever touring car result. But hindsight's a wonderful thing.
Yeah.
Watching back that footage, it made me realise that I'd forgotten that Acura Cos hadn't started the season with that Saltire livery that they're so well known for in '93.
Yeah.
And that only came in when Harry Nuttall actually stepped into the seat.
Yeah.
And the first couple of races, they ran an adaptation of their '92 livery. But yeah, I'd forgotten that, because that Saltire livery is so well loved that.
Yeah.
People assumed it was run all season, but it wasn't.
Yeah, he also bought another interesting sponsor, didn't he, Harry?
Yes. Quite an interesting character, apparently.
Yes, he's a lord now, isn't he, I think?
Yes, yeah. It's an interesting one.
Gareth Howe followed the lead of the Works Ford team by pulling his Ford Sierra Sapphire out of the Donington meeting because of a lack of development. Alex, you know quite a bit about Gareth and his attempts to enter the BTCC during this era. What can you tell us about this, Todd? And probably the usual disclaimer when we mention Gareth Howell in the Super Touring era as
Thank you. Yes, because no matter how many times we mention it, everyone goes, well, at least he got to go in a touring car in the end. And as Paul O'Neill told us before, the amount of times that people still go up to him and say, Gareth, why don't you tell us about that time you were trying to build your own Fords? And he was like, that's not me. So this is not Gareth Howell, who raced in the Touring Car Championship from the early 2000s up until about 2007, 2008. This was another Gareth Howell. And yes, he followed the lead of the Works Ford team, didn't he, by pulling out. But that's about where the comparison ends, shall we say. And I don't mean any disservice by this, but most people have heard about Gareth's attempt to run a Mondeo in 99, but it is less well known that he also tried to build, well, he did build and try to run his Ford Sierra Sapphire in 93. Again, a self-built machine entered by Gareth Howell Racing. As private teams go, I mean, this was the truest sense of a private team. It was a real family effort. The car originally raced in the 1990 British Production Saloon Car Championship before they built it up to Group N spec, where he raced it in 1991 and 1992. But this car never actually saw its It never got onto the touring car grid in 93, a bit like his 99 effort. So we don't really know what it could have done, but I can't imagine it would have been up to much. I don't know, Greg, do you know anything more about this car than I do? I'm not sure.
No, it's something I've never seen a picture of it. It was always one of these elusive cars.
Yeah,
I can only think it would have been not very successful, but yeah, you have to give him credit for trying. But yeah, I don't know really any more than what you know.
Yeah, there's pictures of the Mondeo that he built in 99, so we know that existed.
Yeah.
But all I've got of the 93 car is the media mock-up that was in the media guide. So he was on the entry list, and his car was in there was a mock-up of his car in the entry list, but nobody ever saw it. So,
yeah. As you know, I've got pictures of most super touring cars, but not that one.
Yeah.
Former Grand Prix driver Eric van der Poel was spotted in the team dynamics awning for the weekend, with rumours that the Belgian, who had raced in Formula 1 in 1992 for Fonmetal, was going to race one of the team's BMWs later in the season. Now, guys, this drive never materialised, but van der Poel would end up on the BTCC grid in 1994. Was this sort of the first sign of XF1 drivers looking at touring car racing as a serious career alternative, do you think?
I think so. I don't remember anybody remember anything prior to this.
The only one you could say is Palmer. Palmer did 91 with BMW to mixed success.
Yeah,
I was going to mention Ian Ashley of 1993.
Yes,
in his Demon Tweaks Cavalier.
Yes,
I don't think he was doing it for the same reason as Eric van der Poel, but he was ex Grand Prix driver.
He was. Yeah. I didn't know that until who was it? Andrew Charman told me that he'd. He'd been in F1. I'd never realised that. But yes, he was an ex-Grand Prix driver too. When you look back, 93, certainly then 94, you had Tarquini, van der Poel, Lammers. Yeah. Okay, Rydell didn't get to F1, but he was certainly a single-seater background. Reed later on in the...
Rydell was lined up for Formula 1, really, wasn't he?
He was, yeah.
Doing what he was doing in Japan. That's when he got his illness, when he had the collapsed lung, that it all sort of changed for him, didn't it?
Yeah, and you look at, Anthony Reed, another one that didn't quite make it to F1, but, did well in F3 and then move across to touring cars as an alternative. So, yes, definitely it was becoming more and more of an opportunity. Warwick is another one that he did the Toka shootout at the end of 93. So, yeah, the drivers were definitely looking at this and thinking, actually, this is not a bad idea.
I always got the impression like Group C was beginning to decline. So, and the amount of Formula One teams was dropping. So, they were always looking for an alternative form of income. And I think touring cars was on the up at that point.
Yeah, definitely.
Qualifying for this race was over two sessions. One in the wet on the Friday and a rare dry session on the Saturday. BMW's Steve Soper was quickest in both sessions, but it was nowhere near as dominant as the qualifying session for the opening race of the season, as both Rob Gravett and Keith O'Dor threatened to usurp Soper. Adam, after the first race of the season at Silverstone, it did look like BMW were going to wart the season. So it must have been refreshing for Toka and the fans to see maybe different drivers challenging for pole this time around.
I think it was. I mean, 100%. I mean, you think of any sport, nobody from a fan's perspective going to watch it live or to watch it on the TV, nobody wants to see complete dominance. You know, it's not a good watch, is it? You know, you at the end of watching what's going on out, elsewhere from second and further down the grid. So I think it was a breath of fresh air. I think it was well needed look at Renault. You know, who needed a result more than them? You know, you've got 92 champ of Tim in the car for one. Yeah. You know, he wants a good car, he needs a good car. That's what he's in there to do, but there's only so much you can do with what you've been given. So I think with them wet conditions that have come in, it just helps, but it's good. I think it just put it to bed early doors when people thought there was going to be a BMW dominance. All of a sudden, the rain came and it just changed everything. It was good.
Friday's wet session had been the usual wet but drying scramble to be on the right tyres at the right moment, and Soper had timed it to perfection. In the dry session, O'Dor looked particularly smooth and quick and ended up putting his Nissan Primera on the front row alongside Soper. Greg, this was the first season of the JanSpeed Nissan program. Was it great to see the car finally getting towards the front end of the field on merit?
Yeah, I think so. I always like the JanSpeed Nissans. I think they always look very well prepared, but often they fail to deliver. I think they were always that, not an underdog, but they just didn't quite deliver what was hoped. And I think as well, Keith O'Dor was a really, really fantastic driver, you know, clearly taken from us too early. And 1993 really was his strongest season in the British touring cars. So yeah, I think it was really great to see them at the front, but also another manufacturer at the front.
Patrick Watts followed up his excellent showing in the opening meeting at Silverstone with a second race start in his new Mazda. I'm happy with the position we have on the grid, but a little surprised. We have still got a lot to learn, he said after the session. Alex, was it good to see Patrick finally getting a chance to show just what you can do in a touring car with quite a competitive Mazda?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it was great because, let's be fair, the 1992 Mazda was rubbish, wasn't it? It was an awful yeah. car. Although, in fairness, actually, it did have a very strong showing in this race. It's probably a stronger showing, actually, in the hands of Ian Cantwell, the privateer in the Mazda 323. But yeah, he'd had a great start to the season at Silverstone, finishing sixth, I think it was sixth in the ZDOS and the what do you call it, the plum and custard car.
Plum and custard.
And so yeah, it was great because Patrick was clearly a very talented driver that was held back by particularly poor machinery that first year. So yeah, it's about time Patrick Watts had a bit of good luck in BTCC, isn't it? Because he always, as I say quite regularly, he always seems to be on the back end or the receiving end of something. And yeah, it was good because I love that car as well. It's a beautiful looking car, I thought. I think it's a bit of a Marmite car, but me personally, I loved it.
Alain Menu pulled out a sensational performance to drag his Renault into eighth, whilst Ray Belm was top of the privateers. It all meant that it was shaping up to be an exciting race. The touring car race took place immediately after the Grand Prix, and if you thought Ayrton Senna and co. had to deal with bad enough weather, it was even worse for the Tin Tops as the heavens opened as the cars pulled up onto the grid. The warm-up lap almost accounted for Patrick Watts as his Mazda spun. I was following Keith O'Dor up to McLean's, where there was a river. He had a moment, and so did I, but in order to miss him, I had to spin, he said after the race. He had also unfortunately taken out most of the marker points on the track too. Alex, it was nearly a first trip to Patrick Watts' sympathy corner this series there, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, Patrick can't do things normally, can he? He had to take out the markers and had to spin, but yeah. It's typical Patrick, isn't it? He can't just have a good weekend. As I was just saying, he was, you know, he always seemed to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. But it's sort of almost very similar to his 2004 performances in the in the Masters race as well. Bless him. But the weather was awful, wasn't it? It was absolutely horrendous. I certainly don't think they'd run a race there now in those conditions. I think that's clear to see. But it was a Grand Prix weekend, so they had to get on with it, didn't they?
Yeah. I know we spoke about this before we started recording this, Al and Levi, but when I was it 2008 when I was in the Toledo? It was bad. Like, it was bad. I think now they probably would have started under the safety car.
Yeah.
Purely because of the visibility side of it and how deep some of the water was. But, you know, they're still go at it. You know, single seaters, definitely not. You know, they'd be off in the, you know, going out the pits because they just haven't got the ride height to clear the running water. But, you know, it's still bad. And because it's so undulating at Donington, you have such a lot of running water coming across areas of the circuit, but not even straight across it because it's on a hill, it will come diagonal. So when the car hits it, you know, you can't see it. Secondly, when you do then maybe know roughly where it is the following lap, you don't know how deep it is from one lap to the next. So you expect to apply the next lap and then you don't. But then three laps later, then all of a sudden you do. So, but the conditions were bad. But I still think, you know, it's just extremely wet, isn't it? It's just extremely, extremely wet. But like we said earlier on about the headlamps, how are they allowed to run without no lights on?
Yeah, I thought that was bizarre. I thought that was really bizarre.
Like, you just get an immediate black flag, wouldn't you? You'd get told the team to radio to the driver to turn them on, or if you didn't after, you know, two or three laps, you'd be black flagged. Not that you'd be able to see the black flag in those conditions, but
Alan at one point wasn't even running his wiper.
He was purely relying on Rain-X out.
But I've heard before, and I don't know how true it is, and I need to investigate it. It's apparently he never had his wiper on because he was his apparently so. It was his single seater thing.
Yeah.
Because he was used to having no wiper.
If it's beating off really well, then yeah. And I think you've always got that danger of if there's bits of oil and bits of grease or stuff coming out of other cars and stuff, and then you put it on the windscreen as well. Yeah. Once it's smeared once, that's it.
Well, look at Thruxton 98 that year. When all the oil was being sprayed onto the
It's like when you run out of washers in your car. You just know. If I try and put the washer on and the wiper's coming automatically. Yeah. You've told yourself for five minutes prior.
Don't do it.
Don't do it because I know what's going to happen. But there's that little voice in the back of your head that says, just do it because you might just have a little bit of water that comes out that's enough. You know, in the salt's been on the road, the gritters have been out, and then all of a sudden you do it, you're like, no, why have I done it? I can't see.
But it's one for the pod, actually, one for our listeners. If you find a bit of footage with Alan Menu using his windscreen wipers, come and debunk the theory that he never uses wipers. So there we go.
Or alternatively, footage of Alan Menu with a windscreen full of spray and not using his wipers inexplicably.
Honestly, I can't remember who told me that, but apparently he never used his wipers.
As the cars lined up on the grid, the raining conditions were absolutely appalling. Now, Greg, you were there, as we've mentioned. Hopefully you at least had an umbrella or, unlike Paul Fernley, at least some Wellington boots without holes in as well.
Yeah, I think I had umbrella, tarpaulin, wellies without holes in them, multiple coats. Yeah, everything to try and stop it. But I think everybody was just soaked.
Soper got away well from pole, whilst O'Dor alongside him was a bit slower. Watts found his sequential gearbox was in neutral and then was very slow away. All bar the unfortunate Nadell made it round Redgate. Tiff didn't even reach the corner before he had made contact with Ian Cantwell's Mazda 323 and speared off into the gravel and into retirement.
Even the warming up lap, I wasn't too keen on the race. It really is. I mean, visibility is terrible. And the touring cars, they steam up so much. You get water inside those metal shells and the shell gets cold, so it all steams like a pressure cooker inside.
The run down to the old hairpin would take out two more victims. Patrick Watts spun after contact, meaning Matt Neal and Bobby Verdenroy became entangled as they avoided the spinning Zedos. Matt was out immediately, whilst Verdenroy got to McLean's before something seemed to seize and he pulled off. Watts, meanwhile, got round as far as the Melbourne hairpin before a front hub, damaged in the mayhem, collapsed. Neil was furious. I tried looking out the side to get my bearings and I couldn't even see the edge of the track, he said back in the pits. Adam, did you think Matt had a right to be cross there with the conditions?
I think it's more frustration than anger, really. It's just, you look at the footage, he's tried to go around the outside of Verdenroy, you know, sort of halfway around the craners, and Verdenroy wouldn't have even known he was there. But you put yourself in that position, it's the risk you take, particularly in those conditions. And just run out of road. And literally, once you hit the grass at the craners, you are just a passenger. And I think Matt needs to be thankful that the gravel trap stopped him because you gain speed, you're downhill, you lose everything. And then, you know, fortunately, eventually hit the gravel trap and it stopped him. Otherwise, that was going to be quite a hefty shunt and probably would have damaged the shell of the car there. So that would have been a costly one.
It was at Melbourne that the next drama occurred. Will Hoy and Eugene O'Brien went into the gravel together. I was powerboating and then I ran up the beach, said Will after the race. He'd locked up under braking and the engine had died, giving him no chance. O'Brien managed to get through the gravel, but a stone had smashed the distributor cap and the consequential misfire soon forced him to call it a day. Greg, six cars out and it's not even the end of the first lap. It's probably the absolute carnage we expected to see, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think so. You know, when you watch the film or the footage back again, the visibility close to zero, cars with misted up windows, massive puddles running across the track. I think what surprised me as well, how dark it was as well. And we know TV cameras will make it lighter than what it really was. It must have felt like they were driving in at night, terrible conditions.
Yeah. Adam, just touching on that, do you think as drivers as well, sort of in those conditions, you then start to get a little nervous and then maybe drivers make mistakes because of sort of the nerves about the conditions when they're in that sort of scenario?
Yeah, I think so. I think some people are quite nervy about it, but I used to, as you guys know, we've spoken about again this before, but I used to thrive on it because I was never in the fastest car. There's so many more variables. It's not just about, you know, how fast your engine is, how good your car is, how good the team is, and just those sort of main components together.
Yeah.
When it comes to conditions like that, a lot of that goes out the window because the grip level changes, obviously you've got all the running water that I've just spoken about, the depth of the water, the aquaplaning, the finding the grip, because the grip's not in the normal conventional areas of the normal racing line. You know, some majority of the corners, there's the higher grip on the outside, but then you're running the risk of being closer to the gravel trap and the grass. And, you know, look at Will Hoy that locked up with a sequential box going into the Melbourne loop. And again, that's just a bit of a, you know, what can happen with the sequential box. You know, once it's locked and it's done that and the diff locks, and you just, again, he was just a passenger. He couldn't get it out of gear and try and just coast. And there's so many more things that come into it. So it's not all about the horsepower anymore, because you're all putting the power on at different areas. You've got to control wheel spin, which is something you probably generally don't normally have to do unless you're coming out of a real tight hairpin, such as like the one at Croft or Knockhill. So there's so many other things to come into it. And that's why I used to love it, because I used to get more excited about it, because you could pass around the outside exactly what Senna did. You could do passes around the outside, inside, and just taking full advantage. If someone's been a bit hesitant, you know, more so than others, it just enabled you to have a better fighting chance.
Joe Vinkelhock was the next driver to retire, with his BMW engine cutting out on the start of the second lap. Cleland moved into second ahead of O'Dor, with Wyn Percy, Menu, Allam, Gravett and Harvey following. There was then a big gap to the fast-starting Cantwell, who led the rest through. Harvey disposed of Gravett on lap two and Allam the next time round, whilst Menu went the other way after losing it down the Craner curves. He dropped to eighth place, nearly 23 seconds behind leader Soper, but well clear of Cantwell, who was in turn 10 seconds ahead of the next pack, led by Ian Ashley. Alex, it was the Renault boys providing all the entertainment in the opening laps after the chaos of lap one, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. I mean, Tim was scything through the field, and I mean, you know, half the field had fallen off themselves as well at this point. But Tim and Alan were just, well, Alan was spinning, but eventually came back through the field. But yeah, they were flying. Those Renaults were really, really quick. And they were providing all the entertainment, all the passing, all the exciting drama was the two Renaults moving up through the field from their mid-grid positions, which, it was brilliant. Harvey was passing cars left, right and centre. And when he wasn't passing cars, he was reeling them in, you know, like there was no tomorrow. He had some real pace that day in that Renault.
There was no doubting the speed of the Renaults in these conditions. Harvey and Menu set a series of fastest laps, with Menu slightly the quicker of the two as he recovered from his spin.
Harvey and Renault doing a superb job, but it's very much a teamwork effort. Using Michelin tyres, and in wet weather conditions, tyre choice can be critical. A good wet tyre can perhaps find 1 or 2 seconds, and they're making very good use of it here as Harvey comes round the claims.
Adam, Palmer's there talking about the wet tyres and the advantage the right tyre can give you. From a driver's perspective, is he right, do you think?
Yes. I think everybody would have started on, would have, you know, conditions like that, you would have started on an absolute brand new set of tyres. Maybe you would have put scrubbed ones on that have already, you know, had a bit of a heat cycle through them just to get rid of the shine, just bed them in slightly, which would have got onto the rear. But fronts, 100%, you'd have started on a brand new set on fronts, because yes, you can have that significant, you know, difference in speed from a used set to a new set in conditions like that. If that was more of a wet trap, but you knew it was going to dry out quite quickly, you know, in the warmer climate, you know, later on in the year, you'd have probably started on used ones, knowing you were going to get to that dry point. But yeah, that have started on new tyres and new wet tyres, the way the tread is and the blocks on, you know, the way they're sat on top of the tyre. Obviously, you want the sharp edges. You'll notice a brand new set of tyres has real sharp edges, and that's the bit that's really cutting through the rain and cutting through the standing water. So you look at a used set where it's got soft, they're more rounded off, it's not as effective. So yes, they can have a big difference in lap time, but I'm sure everybody would have started on a brand new set of front tyres on that one for sure.
On lap six, Harvey moved up to fourth place, passing Percy, and a lap later he dealt with the other Nissan of O'Dor to move into third. Clelland and the Vauxhall Cavalier were also no problem, and by lap eight, Harvey was into second. Greg, tyres or not, this is an impressive drive from Harvey, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I think it was a real champion's drive. I was really impressed, and I was actually a member of the official Tim Harvey fan club at the time. So I'm not sure how many members there were, but I was definitely one of them. So for me, seeing him cut through the field was absolutely amazing. But I think one other question I've got is, what was his performance really, the tyres, or how bad the Renault 19 really was? There was lots of rumours that it was sort of built around a rally car, and Jean Ragnotti was the test driver, and I always have the feeling that it was so bad a car that it made it so good.
Yeah, possibly true, yeah. The bad cars are always pretty good in the wet, aren't they?
Yeah. I always remember when Tim Harvey said he went to France to check to see it for the first time and it had a handbrake fitted to it.
Yeah, it's crazy, isn't it? Absolutely crazy. And I think the reason it did, I think he sort of questioned it and said, but sorry, that car's got a handbrake. And they were like, oh, yeah, Ragnotti likes doing handbrake turns. It's like, brilliant. Okay.
Okay, come in handy at Knock Hill then.
Yeah.
And the last corner at Croft. But I mean, they must have had something right in terms of the chassis. I mean, you know, those conditions. I mean, you looked at the car, it did look like it was on rails at times.
Harvey made short work of the 2.5 second gap to Soper. And at the end of lap 10, he was right on his tail. As they drove up to Redgate, Steve covered the inside line, Tim feinting to the left and Soper moving across to cover the move, allowing Tim to dart down the inside and take the lead of the race.
And Harvey is now, he's very much in the chase. He's going to have a nudge up the inside of Goddard, does he? No, he's not. Now, what he's now got to do, and he sweeps right, he's got to get the line, absolutely right, to get the run on Soper down to the Redgate corner, because that's where most of the overtaking manoeuvres take place, right up behind Soper. He goes to the left, and he's going to the left, because he's going for the right. Soper leaves him just enough room. Harvey's coming down the inside, but Soper's the last of the late breakers, that's for sure. Nevertheless, no, Harvey's through. Soper has to concede the place, and look at those conditions, it's absolutely foul. Soper is clinging on, and he will not give up, that's absolutely sure.
Gravett, meanwhile, was closing in on the Nissan twins, his Peugeot also using Michelin tyres. On lap 10, Gravett made his move on Percy at Goddard's, but it failed and Menu was through in a flash. Gravett came back at him on the outside to Redgate and the pair touched. Gravett would end his race in the gravel. It was a shame because the car was going well, Gravett said after the race. Alex, is it just another of those what-if moments for Peugeot there?
Yeah, it is, isn't it? And there's quite a few of them over the years, isn't there, throughout this period of touring car racing. Yeah, I mean, if anything, it almost shows that it wasn't just the Michelin tyres that were working well on the Renault, because, yeah, the Peugeot had them, and the Peugeot was going well. It wasn't going as quickly as the Renault was. So, yeah, it probably was a what-if moment, and I dare say, had he kept going, Gravett probably would have ended up third on the podium behind the two Renaults. So, yeah, it would have been a strong result. The Peugeot had yet to score a podium in touring cars in the actual championship in that era yet. So it would have been Peugeot's first podium had they got there. But, yeah, another one of those what-if question mark moments that seemed to dog Peugeot throughout the 90s in touring cars, in Britain anyway.
By the end of lap 12, Menu was ahead of O'Dor and looming up on Clelland. A lap later, he was through, but the gap to Soper in second place was over 10 seconds. Surely, Menu couldn't catch him.
And Soper is off! Soper is off! He's still going, he's on the grass, chucking up the mud and desperately fighting to rejoin. Now, this is costing him valuable time. He rejoins, he's on, but there is Alain Menu in the second of the Renault. Overtaking a slower car and now desperately chasing, and is with Steve Soper.
Soper missed a gear going into the old hairpin and went off, meaning Menu was right on his tail. The battle raged on, and on lap 15, Menu locked up and hit Soper into the Melbourne loop. Soper fought back and regained his place at the hairpin before Menu attacked again through the craners and finally took second. He was faster, so I was being horrible, said Soper. Eventually he looked up, gave me a tap, and he was through, which was fair enough, I suppose. Adam, that was a great battle for second in the closing laps of the race there.
Yeah, it was. It's really good. I mean, that's exactly what touring cars was and still is. You know, this is why the fan base is as good as it is, and particularly that era that, you know, this era that we speak about so fondly of. That's what we watched it for. That's what we went there for. And again, in those conditions, I mean, you look at the footage and you look how tight the defensive line Soper was making, like into the Melbourne loop, for instance. He was virtually on the white line. He was that close. But by doing that, it enables Menu or the car behind in any dogfight like that to get the line that he wants, to have the perfect run out of the corner, which then obviously gains you more speed because you've had a better run at it. And obviously Soper's come out a lot tighter. So it's one of them, you can't win. If Soper would have gone on the normal line, Menu would have lunged him and had him up the inside. So he had to do it, and Steve would have known that the Renault would have had a better run coming onto the straight. And that's exactly what eventually happened, you know, coming onto the main straight. And, you know, it's just a good example of, you know, full defensive mode and trying to get the advantage. It's putting pressure on the guy in front. So you're forcing him to make that move. And then you put yourself in a position where you're giving yourself the best chance. But this is like, you know, one of them's been the hunter and one of them's been the hunted. You know, it's just what you have to do in both situations. But it was good. It was fair. It was clean. It was good. Exactly what we want to see.
Sadly, the cameras didn't actually pick up the incident going into the Melbourne loop between where the actual contact occurred. Another memory of mine is just watching as the laps ticked on towards the end of the race, that the front of that Renault was just falling apart more and more by every corner, another little bit of it would come off.
And on the footage, when he did get past him, he did, like, was it going into the first corner where he just caught him slightly, and you could see that the little trim underneath the headlamp sort of sticking out, But it was good, you know. It was, what a great fight! It was really good. I mean, and obviously, if Soper had made the mistake in the first place, Menu wouldn't have been as close as he was. But he decided to grass track him for a bit at first, didn't he? And then he lost so much time. That's what brought him back into it.
There's an example there now of how bad it was. You know, if a man, Mr. Touring Cars himself, Steve Soper, in a car that was as sorted as that BMW was by Schnitzer. Yeah. You know, he went off, so, you know, shows you how tough those conditions were.
And that's what I'm saying, you know, you could have been in the safety car and you still would have had trouble getting around, you know, it was that bad. You can't design a car unless it's a boat to go, you know, to go through conditions like that, you know.
A boat with a handbrake.
So, Tim Harvey leads for Renault. For last year's champion, this is going to be a particularly sweet victory. Tim Harvey, Alain Menu, Renault and Michelin have all worked extremely hard over the last 6 months preparing for this particular occasion. As Harvey checks his mirror, he's well out in front, he's nothing to fear, he just needs to make no mistake whatsoever.
And who would have predicted a 1-2 for Renault Dealer Racing in this, the second round of the Auto Trader British Touring Car Championship? There goes the chequered flag on Tim Harvey, and you can see how delighted he is about that victory. They've worked enormously hard for it.
On to the last lap, and it was a Renault 1-2, with Harvey leading home Menu. Greg, after their performances at the first meeting of the season, it's an almost unbelievable turnaround from the French part there, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I remember driving to the circuit, and we were expecting to see in the main Grand Prix an easy dominant win by the Williams Renault team, and we saw a completely different result. I definitely didn't go to the circuit expecting to see the Renault 19s get any sort of result. So, yeah, I think for them it was a total dream.
Yeah, Renault's only victory being in the touring car race.
Yeah, you wouldn't have written that before you got to the circuit.
Yeah, exactly.
Renault's team manager, Keith Green, explained some of the reasons for the change in its fortunes. After the race, he said, "It's a bit of a bonus. They both drove blindingly well. The tyres were brilliant in the wet, and we had a good setup. We are making progress all the time, but realistically, in the dry, we would have been sixth or seventh at best." Alex, do you agree with Keith's assessment there of the situation?
Yeah, I think that's fair. You know, ultimately, as much as we're sort of saying it wasn't just the Michelin tyres, they definitely played their part. They were clearly a superior wet tyre than anything else in the field. But yeah, they would have progressed from their meeting at Silverstone in the first race of the season, where Menu got a point, and I think Tim was out of the points, so they were totally uncompetitive. They'd done quite a lot between the two meetings. I know they had new wishbones and uprights, which are literally finished on the Thursday morning before the race. So, yeah, they'd improved, but not enough to have won the race in the dry. They'd sorted the brakes. I think they went to Snetterton to do a day's testing where they sorted the brakes. And I know Tim Harvey said after the race that the brakes were very good and that he'd creamed everyone on the brakes. So, yeah, they were improving, and that car eventually became a regular point scorer. But it only really excelled in the wet, and I think, you know, that's partly due to the car design and partly because of the Michelin tyres it was using, which were clearly superior.
And I know it's, you know, we can go on about the Michelin tyres, but they weren't the only people using them, were they?
No, the Peugeots had them. No, Peugeots had the two works. Peugeots had them.
Yeah.
So, yeah, as I said earlier, you know, the Renault was quicker than the Peugeot, so it wasn't just the tyres.
Yeah, yeah.
Would Ford have been on them as well if they'd have entered the race?
Yes, I think they would have been. Yeah, I think, Roush had Michelins, I think. Not 100%, though.
But could have been interesting then.
That would have been interesting, yeah, because Ford looked back at this race and that, well, not now, but at that time we think, oh, we should have ended after all.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but you guarantee if they'd have done that, it'd have been dry.
Yeah. And embarrassed themselves.
And, yeah, and exactly, like, yeah. You just can't afford to take that risk. No. When you're 5 seconds off the pace. That just would have been an absolute embarrassment, wouldn't it?
Yeah. So. No, the thing is, Ford were marketing that new Mondeo, weren't they? It was the Sierra replacement. Nobody wanted to get rid of the Sierra. And this Mondeo was their huge marketing campaign for that new car, which was the first global car, wasn't it, the Mondeo? But, yeah, so they couldn't mess around with it. But I bet there was someone there going, oh, actually, I wish we'd had a go at that.
And don't forget, these are the days where, you know, we'd on a Sunday, sell on a Monday. Like,
yeah, yeah, exactly, yeah.
They wouldn't have sold a single car on the Monday.
You're looking at that Monday. You're looking at that Monday running around the back of the grid going, no thanks.
Yeah.
Although I have to say, I didn't pop to the Renault dealership to buy my Renault 19 Chamard on the Monday.
Did you not?
No.
Got a good handbrake. For this series of stories from Super Touring, we are delighted to be teaming up with Brands Hatch to give away two tickets to Super Touring Power 2, which is being held at the famous circuit on the 29th and 30th of June 2024. The award-nominated event was a smash hit last year when its debut edition transported fans back to the 90s, and this year's event will once again celebrate one of touring car racing's most fondly remembered eras. To enter the competition, just answer the following question. Who was the first ever guest to star on Stories from Super Touring? Send your answers to pod@1990sbtcc.com and we'll announce the winner on a later episode this series. Meanwhile, let's get back to the episode.
Most people say it was all down to the tyres, but was it? A great deal was, said Harvey in the winners' press conference. They were fantastic, but there's a lot more to it than that, which is why the Peugeot drivers aren't here. Adam, I think we've touched on this a bit already, but do you think Tim's assessment is right there?
Yeah, you know, yes, the tyres have obviously played a big factor in it, but you also don't know that if another five teams run Michelins, how would they have done either? So, but yeah. I don't, you know, it wouldn't matter what tyre you're on going when you're aquaplaning through, you know, aquaplane, you're just a passenger. So, there's, like I said already, that there's so many different factors that come into it in conditions like that. And, you know, he still beat Menu, so he still beat his teammate.
Yeah.
You know, he's no slouch, we know that. Tim was a 92 champ. You know, he knows how to drive at the front. The tyres were good, but you still need a decent setup. So the team had done the homework on providing a good setup for both drivers. But it's the driver that plays the biggest part in moments like those in the races. where, yes, if it had been dry, Steve probably would have been on pole and he probably would have won the race. He probably would have been a BMW, as people were expecting that to be after round one. But he did what he needed to do and surpassed everyone's expectations, including the teams, probably. They realised, actually, yeah, the chassis is pretty good. And, you know, was it a case of them just being underpowered? You know, and that's why they were struggling as much as they were. But like I've said before, you don't need all the power in conditions like that. It's how you use the power you've got.
Let's hear now what Tim had to say to the BBC Sport cameras after the race.
The most atrocious conditions I've ever raced in. The first lap down the Crane of Curves, I really didn't know where the circuit was at 100 miles an hour, and it was really pot luck on that first lap. When everybody got strung out a little bit, okay, you could take a bit of time, but the most diabolical conditions I've ever raced in.
Soper was relatively happy to retain his championship advantage with third place, whilst Cleland had made his Cavalier much more drivable in the wet and hung on to fourth. O'Dor was fifth, going as quickly as possible without jeopardising his car, and Alan finished sixth, with Julian Bailey seventh and Ian Flux rescuing some points for Peugeot in eighth, though he was running Dunlop tyres on his 405 rather than the favourable Michelins on the two works cars. Ian Cantwell would finish as the top privateer in ninth, the best result of his touring car career. Greg, seeing as Cantwell is unfortunately probably unlikely to feature in many episodes of Stories from Super Touring in the future, let's give him a bit of coverage here. That's a good drive from the privateer. In what was a pretty poor car, don't you think?
Yeah, I think he got a really fantastic result. And as we said, the Mazda 323F was a pretty bad car.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes you just had to take what was available to you as a privateer and you just made the best of it.
Yeah.
I think he had a reasonable team running it. If I remember correctly, it was the same team that ran Carl Jones's Duckham's RS500 Asquith Autosport. So I think he had a good team around him. But yeah, it was a bad car, but he just really made the best of it. And as a privateer, you know, you just have to gain every benefit you can from the odd weekend when it all aligns itself. And I think he did it that weekend.
Yeah, he didn't put a foot wrong. You know, at no point was he off the track or anything, and he kept on the road and got the only win of his touring car in the Privateers Championship, the only win of his very short career, because he only ever raced this season.
Yeah.
And by halfway through the season, he withdrew and was never to be seen on the grid again. So fair play to him. It was to keep, as Adam just said, anyone finishing this race deserves a pat on the back, and I thought Ian did really well here.
Yeah, he was a really nice guy as well. And often the privateers in that time, they were really friendly people to talk to. Hmm. But as you said, he was there for 1 year and then never saw him again.
Yeah, yeah.
Ian Khan finished 10th, followed by James Kay, Ian Ashley and David Pinkney. 13 retirements all there, Alex. Hardly a surprise in such conditions.
13 retirements, six of them on the first lap.
Yeah.
You know, as I've just said it again, I'm going to say it again, Adam, as he said, anyone finishing this race deserves praise, because this, along with, I would say, possibly Brands 95 in that horrific rain weekend in June, I think these are the worst rain conditions I've seen in touring cars since.
There's wet races and there's wet races, yeah. And that is one of those extreme ones.
I'm trying to think now. Silverstone 99, the finale, that was pretty wet. They stopped racing after a few laps. In fact, I don't think they got going, if I remember rightly. Brands 95, as I said. Croft 97, but not the actual race day, but that was pretty bad on the build-up. But yeah, definitely one of the worst touring car weather-wise conditions I can remember. So fair play to anyone keeping it on the track. Let's remember these super tourers were a lot less sophisticated than the machines later on as well.
Yeah.
You know, so a lot less aero. So yeah, fair play to anyone who kept it on the track. So no, I'm not surprised 13 retirements at all, because it was grim out there.
And didn't Tim say in his interview it was the worst conditions he's ever driven in?
Yeah, yeah.
And honestly, it doesn't get any worse than that.
No.
It's now time for our question game. So, producer Dan, going to pass over to you. Have you got your question ready for us?
Here we go.
I know you're all looking forward to it because every time I come out with one of these, I get a lot of complaints in the comments. So it was unlucky 13 indeed for those retirements, but the Renault 19 was very lucky indeed. Very unlikely result, and it was only repeated several more times over the season. So in total, how many more podiums did the Renault 19 cars get in the season?
What, after these two?
After this weekend, how many more podiums in the rest of the season did the two Renault 19s get?
Three.
I was going to say three.
Yeah.
Okay, that was a little bit easy.
No, we got it right.
Let's go on this. We've got some momentum here. We can debate in the comments before. Should this next question count? Okay. What track did those come at?
Donington.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't just a wet weather specialist car, it was a Donington specialist car.
It must have
come in really good use.
I like the way you said it was easy, the first one. It's only easy if you know the answer.
Well, it was both the guest and the host knew the answers. So I think it's one of the first times for a while we've had it where both have got it.
So Donington, the penultimate race of the season, Alan wins, and it's a Renault 1-2.
Yeah.
And then Alan finished second in a race to Paul Radisic, I think.
Is correct.
Right. Okay,
Alan Menu got second place in race one and won race two. It was a 2-3 for Renault, technically.
Sorry.
Harvey was third in race one and retired from race two. Paul Radisic won the first race and was second in the second race.
Yeah, that was a great race, actually. And it was in the wet again. But that was the race where Radisic was nudging him coming up to the Melbourne hairpin.
Yes.
And Menu just blows him a kiss.
Yeah.
And very sporting from Radisic, actually, because he sort of backs off, whereas some other drivers might not have backed off and just taken the place anyway. So, But I love that. And Murray just going, he's blowing him a kiss.
Eddie's blowing him a kiss!
After one of the most unlikely results in the Super Touring era of touring car racing, the expected BMW whitewash was tinged with the yellow as Tim Harvey took his unfancies Renault 19 to victory. I'd like to thank Greg Denton for joining us once again to look back at this race, and we hope that we will see you again on Stories from Super Touring.
Yeah, I think it's been really great to join you all today and reminisce again on another special Super Touring memory. And I think for me, it's really nice to be on the other side of the microphone this time. So yeah, thank you for inviting me.
Thanks, Greg. It's been great having you.
And our thanks, as ever, go to you guys for listening to the show. And if you enjoyed today's episode, please make sure to give us a review, 5-star rating, and subscribe to the podcast feed on your podcast app of choice. You can also submit your questions to our panel for our season finale Q&A with Greg Haynes. So if you have a question or thought about the Super Touring era of touring car racing, don't forget to email them to us using pod@1990sbtcc.com. You can also use that address to send us a comment about today's episode, the podcast in general, or if you have a question or suggestion for a future episode. And in the meantime, we will see you next week. Goodbye.